Welcome to another inspirational message from Hillsong Church, London.
A couple of weeks back, and I sort of wasn't really introducing a thought, as in forethought, really. It was a bit of a take the things that I saw as important last year and sort of bring them all together and sort of remind us as we move forward. And so this week I'm going to attempt it's an attempt because my iPad just keeps freezing on me, which there's one reason why you always stick with handwritten notes, isn't it? Because the only thing that happened with handwritten notes is you can lose them, but technology always lets you down. We're back in action. So, talked about four commitments that we've sort of got to commit ourselves to. And just a quick recap on those, if you weren't here, or if you're anything like me, struggle to remember what someone spoke about last week, let alone those 2 weeks ago, right? And so talk about four commitments that we've got to be committed to. First one was let's remain committed to the gospel, which is a strange statement itself. Let's remain committed to the gospel. Why would you remain committed to the gospel? And what does that mean? Ephesians chapter 3, verse 7, Paul, who he's writing to the Ephesian people, and he says, "This is my life work, helping people understand this message." And I think to a degree, we've got to be able to go, well, this is my life work. Every single one of us, I think, if we can be committed to going, you know what, I want to help people understand the message of Jesus. I think the message of Jesus is important. And we've got to make sure we're committed to not getting off track when it comes to the message of Jesus in our own lives. Because if we understand this, and this is just a quick recap, is we as human beings have a great propensity towards religious behavior. In other words, we have a tendency towards that. Like, if I was to ask you, do you need to be reminded about doing good to get good? Most of us would go, nah, that's sort of how I was raised. I get that. If I was to ask, you know, how many people struggle to realize that there's a penalty for doing things wrong? And most of us get that. But how often do we have to be reminded of the grace of God? We almost have to remind ourselves of the grace of God almost every waking minute of our lives if we're not careful, because we have this propensity to move into this religious mindset or this religious thinking. And to simplify, you know, religious thinking, I've just been trying to keep simplifying thoughts, is a propensity towards that it's a work-based rightness. That if I, and that rightness that brings about favor, so if I work my way into a rightness, I'm going to win favor from other people, I'm going to win favor from the God picture that I create or whatever it might be. And we have this propensity towards it. And hence if we're not careful, we live in a world that is trying to force its way upon us. And I say a world, and you think, well, who the heck is the world? I usually ask myself that statement every time I say it and every time you read it, which is really, the world is, it's just the established philosophies of the day, the ways of the age, when it's referring to the world we live in, the ways of the age. And the ways of the age, we're moving into this sort of philosophical type morality, which is a little bit like taking concepts of right and concepts of wrong, and sometimes there's almost this sort of rewriting wrong and rewriting right, and all based on people's philosophical perspectives and a little bit of God and a little bit of man and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and this is what we think is right. And now we'll set up a behavior that brings about reward or punishment if you don't keep the rules. That's essentially religious behavior. And so we've got to constantly be committed to the fact that I'm a believer in the gospel. I'm a believer in what the work of Christ does and all that sort of stuff. So we've got to be constantly in a place where, you know, this is one of the things I need to be committed to as a person. Otherwise, I can lead people astray myself, or I can lead myself astray as an individual. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Then I talked about, second point was just talked about the fact that we've just got to have a commitment to really authentic social connection, the dynamic, just how we relate to people, how we relate to each other. It's if we don't establish a sense of a commitment to something, once again, and I'm not playing on the word commitment, but if you don't commit yourself to something, it's easy to stray away from it and just wander off. And so this authentic social connection that I talked about, and I just want to pick up, maybe just delve a little bit further into it, probably go over some of the stuff, old ground. Everything I'm going to say today, none of it is new. There's two reasons why I know none of it's new, because what I'm reading from is nearly 2,000 years old, so it's not new. It's a bit hard. I've not counted how many words are in the New Testament, but to find something new every time you speak is not easy, because it's shorter than a novel to read. And so coming up with something new, but the challenge for us is can we take something that is an eternal principle, because there's an eternal God who's revealed in this and his ways, and can I keep it fresh in my life? Can I keep it current in my life? I think we've got to be careful, just as I'm talking about this, that we don't fall into this modern day trap, if we're not careful, of please entertain me with the word of God today. Please impress me with it. Whatever it might be, we've got to be careful that we don't fall into that place, and more go, well, I need to be reminded of some things that are eternal. So some things that pass through the ages, some things that are not contextualizing to the time that we live in, but they're actually things that pass through all the times that we live in. And how can I keep it current? How can I keep it fresh in my life? I think they are the real challenges of what we believe and what we're about. You get what I'm saying? So I talked about this this in the context of, and I think if you the social connection thing, if you hear it within this context, within the age that we live in, are we an antidote to what's going on in the world? Are we contrary to what is going on in the world? Or are we just replicas? And remember, what's the world? The age, the day, the philosophy of man, popular opinion. We live in an age, if we're not careful, where our culture is defined by celebrity. Celebrity view, celebrity opinion, celebrities' philosophies, and all those sorts of things. It's like, whoa, Sweetheart, just sing songs. That's what you do well. Act in a movie. I'm not quite sure, because you're a good actress, that you've got a great philosophy. If it's not about sweethearts, it's about gentlemen's, whichever it might be. But our philosophy, I mean, if we're believers on life and the way we approach it should be defined by this. Would you agree? Right? Because if we go to the age we live in, because we've got to be aware, what's the age we live? Age we're living in is polarizing at a rapid rate. Difference of opinion is no longer a reality. It's difference of side. Where once we could have had a difference of opinion might be, well, you know, you've got a different opinion to me on something, but it doesn't mean I want to kill you. Or it doesn't mean I want to turn you into my enemy, or it doesn't mean that I want to tear your life down. I want to destroy you. It used to be we just disagreed. We agreed to disagree, and then we'll just let it all come out. In the long run, we'll see who's right. Now that's how 60-year-olds think. But the world we live in today is if you disagree with me, you watch me tear you down. You watch me trying to debase everything that you are because your agreement, you do not agree with me. And because you do not agree with me, I'm going to set you up as my enemy in life. That's the world we live in. And everyone's not just, is there a difference of opinion? We polarize into differences that start with a difference of opinion, and then we attack each other. That's so much of what's going on in the world that we live in, and if we're not careful on a grand scale of life, it seems to be there, but we've got to be careful that we don't allow that grand scale of life to pull it down into our own lives when we're people of faith, meaning we actually think what Jesus had to say is important. Do you get what I'm trying to say? All right. So that's the context of what I'm saying. You know, we're in this world, but we're not supposed to be of it, right? So let me just grab a few thoughts. So I sort of started with, and this is a bit of a go-over, Colossians chapter 5 and verse 13 says, serve one another with love. Now, what's interesting in that is if you think, okay, serve one another with love. But out of what? Out of how, right? If we'll start there. If you back up a few verses from serve one another in love, Paul says, he goes, use your freedom to serve one another in love. Right? So Passion Translation puts it like this. Freedom means that we become so completely free of. Right, so it's because sometimes we go, I don't know about you, and I may have posed this question two weeks ago, but what does freedom mean? He who the Son sets free is free indeed. We're all these sorts of, but have you ever asked yourself, well, what does freedom mean? So I'm going to use my freedom to serve one another in love. What is my freedom? What does it mean? Well, in the Passion Translation, it helps us out because it says, freedom means that we become so completely free of self-indulgence. What's the world we live in is so full of self-interest. And I think the church, if it's going to be an antithesis of the world we live in or the age we live in, should be a classic environment of a collective self-interest, where we're all concerned about the common good, and we're all concerned about others, not just me, and the better everybody else is, the better things are going to be for me. In fact, the more I care about others, the better I become anyway. Right? That's what church should look like. We live in, if we're not careful, we're in, and I think there's a coming generation coming through that is naturally recognizing that self-indulgence and self-interest does not help anybody. But we should be the examples of it. That's church should be a great example of the, of, and it should always be an antithesis of the world that we, is that the right word? I'm not smart enough to get, I try and add new words to my vocabulary because I come from Australia and we have only this many, and you come to England and have this many. And so I've got Ben sitting there nodding, and Ben's my approval meter, right? I know you shouldn't seek approval from people, but I figure if I'm going to seek approval from people, I'm going to seek it from the right people. So as long as Ben's got a smile on his face when I'm speaking, I feel like I'm doing okay. So free of self-indulgence. You know, where does the self-indulgence often come from? It comes from a misplaced identity, meaning who am I as a person? Self-indulgence is actually the, if you get into the Bible and you understand the concepts of the Bible, that self-indulgence is actually a fruit of what we would call fallen nature. It's a fruit of that. It's not what it is. It's a fruit of it, right? And when I said about us, we need to be committed to the gospel, for example. Because see, what the gospel does is sets us free of, or redeems us from, these are the words, from a fallen nature, and restores us back into a original intent nature, which is revealed to us when we look at the person of Jesus. Right? And so when we're thinking of a commitment to the gospel, because see, a commitment to the gospel, some of the fruits of understanding that the power of the gospel and the power of the cross and how it works in my life is, part of its fruits are, is I'm free from guilt, I'm free from condemnation, I'm free from shame, I'm free from self-hatred, I'm free from self-loathing, I'm free and I'm healed from pain that comes when other people hurt me and other people let me down and other people betray me. The cross actually brings brings another life where those things no longer affect my life. Yet if that's not at working in my life, it's amazing how living a life that's constantly under a shadow of guilt, constantly under a shadow of condemnation, constantly under a shadow of fear of judgment, constantly under a sense of personal self-hatred, or that goes into some form of self-loathing, or I'm lashing out because I've been hurt, or see, that's how I treat other people out of those things. But if I'm now, hey, I'm free. So those things no longer are the things that rule me. So now I've got to use that freedom that I'm not being ruled by, and I've got to engage other people from that perspective. No, this is better than you're responding. I know that, right? you get... Right, no, this is, I know, it's like, I'm thinking, I know, because you're the 11 o'clock service. This is where the smart people come. All right, so he says, so use that freedom to serve one another in love. You know, the challenges on that is that, you know, to serve just simply means to do something for somebody else, for their benefit. And I want to keep going over this because I talked about this yesterday, and I was talking to someone who's a psychologist, and I said, you know, if you actually serve people for their benefit, not for yours, and you engage in this activity, it's actually going to make you happy. And some people said, talking to the psychologist friend, they said, sent text to her, is that true? Is he right? See, I'm not stupid. That's what I wanted to go. I can read the books too. And the Bible shows it. But if you actually engage in towards other people, instead of allowing the whom you were before you encountered Jesus, character traits or behaviors to rule you, and you actually, instead of going self-indulgent, serving people from a self-indulgent perspective, and you actually start to do things for other people, it will make you happy. It'll make you happy. It'll just, because it releases serotonin in the brain, and the serotonin is your happy drug. That's why we do so many selfish things and addictive things to try and get serotonin released. Now, we don't know that's what we're doing, but that's what we're doing, to try and be happy. But Jesus gives a better way. You can actually do things that aren't destructive, which is do things for other people, and you will embark in this. Yeah? Right, so he says, so and just to serve one another in love. What is that? Just, and I know this is a bit of a recap, but it's, if you were to take, I don't know, take 1 Corinthians chapter 13, read out love is. If you, it all depends what translation you might be reading. Some of it, the word love is translated into charity. But simply that word love, agape, to summarize it so that you go, okay, I can get this. I'm gonna agape love people. Just simply means I'm gonna, with well-meaning and kindness, I'm gonna serve people, not for my interest, but for their interest, the betterment of them. And the motive or the behavior is, it's well-meaning. And it's kind. Now, that's not too hard, is it? But my, it's hard to live, easy to say. But that's what Paul says that. And what's interesting, once again, is you go, you know, I have, you know how some people go, well, I have trouble connecting with people. I just don't know how to, I just have trouble connecting. And I have trouble forming, for some people it's I have trouble forming a bond with people. You know, the moment you actually engage somebody in the things of what the Bible talks about, acts of love, releases another chemical in your brain that causes you to bond with the person that you're doing that for. God's fascinating, isn't he? And Paul came up with all of this before psychology and science could prove it. Fascinating, isn't it? Right, so he says, so all I'm trying to say is come on, commit yourself to an authentic social connection where you're thinking about others not based on what they can do for me, what they can give me, what they can bring me, what you do for me. You know, the best way to allow your marriage to turn into a, it's time for a new one. Which is, that's the ways of the world. A lot of people these days, when they get married, they don't expect to be married to the same person for life. I expect to have two, maybe three marriages. Why? Well, because I loved you because of what you could give me. Now you're not giving me that anymore. I don't love you. That's not love in the first place. If you fall in love with someone for what they do for you, you're going to fall out of love because they're going to stop doing it one day. But if you fall in love with someone and it's based on, I love you and it's what I want to do for you, that's not the basis is not what you're doing for me, it's the other way around, you'll probably get through a whole lot of stuff. Right? You with me? I'm not going to get to my third and fourth points, am I? Talked about from that, just talked about probably the one thing that can actually destroy your relationships with other people is taking on offense. Remember, we touched on that one, and whole went through the, you know, if you view offense without sort of going exactly what I said, but If you think of offense not as a moment, but if you think of offense of something that began a life cycle. See, offense is not something, oh, I took offense. No, the moment we fall into the trap that offense leads us into, right? It's like it takes on its own life cycle. There's a cycle to it. And so, you know, Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, where he says, so make allowances for each other's faults. The world we live in, it does not make allowances for other people's faults. We've got a list of hate crimes to make sure that we at least don't talk about them, or whatever we do and all of that. But there seems to this, and you got this, starts off, as I said, this differing of opinion, but now this differing of opinion is like you have a differing opinion because you have a fault that I don't like. You have a weakness, and part of our challenge, and I love when you get into the Bible and you look and you study Jesus, because he's 100%, remember, he's 100% God, but he's 100% man. Sometimes we'll look at it and just go, and just look at one or the other, but look at the both of them. He reveals God to us. He reveals how God relates with the weakness of man, but he's 100% man, and he shows us how man can relate to man in his weakness. Right? And us being able to connect with the weakness of other people and not allow it to mess us up, and then we hit back and mess them up because we haven't been able to accommodate the weakness of other people. That's what makes us judgmental and all of those sorts of things. So he says here, so make allowances for one another. So he says, forgive everyone who offends you. Remember, the Lord forgave you. So just a reminder on this offense thing. The reason why I feel like I could spend every Sunday talk about offense and would still walk out and be offended by the time we got out the foyer. That's how prevalent. It's how, and we're so sensitive to, and we're so justifying our right not to be offended that we've literally denied other people of having weakness, and we've denied other people of having an opinion because we're so protective of our position that I don't find myself offended. Right? And so, you know, just a reminder, what is the fact? How do you know you're starting to take on offense? Something happens and you become displeased. When you become displeased, you lose perspective. So it takes on a life. You lose perspective because you do not arrest yourself. It's the classic, I've got a problem and I'm going to make it a crisis. Here's a small thing and I'm going to blow it out of proportion. And it sounds like, and it comes out of snipey resentments, that sounds like, because see, it takes on a life and it's got a sound, and the sound is, what did you mean by that? What do you mean? What did you there's something more to what you said. No, it's just what I said. No, there's more to it. What did they mean? What did he mean? What did she mean? And we take on this, and the tone is this questioning, but there's this resentment that comes out of it. And then we move it, and it takes on another life, and we take on this entitled position. I'm entitled to hit back at you because of what you said. I'm entitled to hit back at you. Why? Because of what you did. I'm entitled to hit back at you. Why? Because of what you didn't say. I'm entitled to hit back at you because you inferred something. And suddenly this entitlement thing that actually turns into a justification thing. I am angry and I'm attacking and I am justified because of what did you mean by that? Do you see what I'm trying to say? And then you end up, where do you end up? You end up, if you're not careful, because it takes on a life cycle, you just go, I'm out of here. I'm going back to where I came from. And it comes out in all sorts of relationships. Comes out in church relationships. Some people get so offended with you, whoever you are, because everyone's got to blame someone. And I'm going back, and they actually go back to pre-life, pre-Christ life, because somebody, so one person can say something or do something, and the work of Christ, Jesus, I said to our team yesterday, what's happened, the fact that Jesus died on a cross, the most horrendous form of torture that's ever been devised, after he was beaten within, they say, one beating of his, one more would have taken him out. And he, the Bible says it, all of that. And sometimes we say, why do you have to go through all that? I mean, a good question, but. And we go, oh, but that, and somehow that's not enough for us. It's just not enough. It's not enough. I want him to do more. I want more. I want. Now, the good news is he did that so you could have more, but it's just not enough. And so we lose all perspective on what I bought into was what Jesus did for me, and someone didn't acknowledge me when they looked at me and, God's not real. That didn't happen. That doesn't matter. Whoa, and I'm just going to go back to everything that was before. I mean, come on, that's losing perspective. That's not arresting yourself. And then where do you end up? You end up back in this funny place where if you're not careful, you either end back, you go back. It's like, you know, what's the first thing you do when you have a fight in marriage? I'm going to go home to mum. One of the reasons you got married so you didn't have to live with mum, but I'm going to go back. Whatever, we're always going to go back to something because that's the life cycle of it. Or we just stay and we spend our lives in bitterness where everything that comes out of our mouths has got this biting hostility towards the people around us. Right, we got to commit ourselves to serving one another in love. We got to use the freedom that comes our way because of the gospel. And there's lots more you could add to it. But you know what? We've also got to make sure that we don't allow offense to rule our lives, because it'll take you out. It'll actually destroy your freedom, right? Well, Jesus has set me free. Yeah, but you're bitter and no one wants to be around you. Do you get what I'm saying, right? So the next one, third one, I got there. Is really, if I say this, is to a commitment to being bigger, or maybe you put it this way, a commitment to be to bigness, generosity. Now, I don't know what comes to your mind when I use the word generosity. Usually the thought of generosity comes associated with, I've got to pull something out of my pocket and it's money and I've got to be generous. And unfortunately, that's where we leave it. We leave it as in the context of money. But What's interesting, though, is money. You know, Ben spoke about it before. One thing that money will do is magnify who you are. Right? It'll magnify. It'll just, it's like putting a big magnifying glass over who you are. But generosity is a way bigger concept than what you do with money. Right? It's about the who you are. It's about the position you take on things. It's a stance you place yourself in. And I think we've got to be committed to this as people. We're actually going to be committed to being bigger people in the moment. I'm going to take the high road. take the high position on things. But they're not just old sayings. They're actually fundamental truths to build your life on. A commitment to saying, you know what, I'm just gonna be bigger. I'm gonna be the bigger person in this. All right, now, let me just, I guess, you know, in Matthew chapter 5, I'm trying to cut and paste my message at the minute. Message Bible puts it like this. If I pick it up in in verse 43. If you started in verse 39, that's the bit where Jesus says, hey, when someone slaps you, turn the other cheek, right? What's in that fits into context of offense, turning the other cheek, because the turning the other cheek was about when somebody humiliates you, be the bigger person. When someone humiliates you, don't take offense. Be the person that says, your humiliation is not going to define me. Your statements of me are not going to define me. Your criticism of me is not going to define me. Your attempt to embarrass me is not going to define me. He's the one that defines me, right? Now, if you keep reading on, and if I pick it up in Message Bible, verse 43, it says, you're familiar with the old written law, love your friend and its unwritten companion, hate your enemy. Now, I talked about before where we love turning people into enemies. We often think there, well, our enemy is the person who's trying to set a bomb off and blow up London, right? But the context of enemy here is one pitched in attitude towards you. That sort of brings contention a little bit closer to home, doesn't it? Enemy, the one who disagrees with your position, right? So it's the unwritten companion, hate your enemy. I'm challenging that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring the best out in you, not the worst. So when someone's pitched in attitude towards, do they bring the best out or do they bring the worst out? It's your choice. I think we got to, if we're going to really think about the way we want to live our lives, we got to be committed to, how do I let this bring the best out of me? And I would think, you know, I know my own personal, you know, working it out with God thing, one of the challenges, and I guess everyone faces that challenges, is slow down, Gary, think about it. How is this going to bring the best out in you, not the worst? Because if you're anything like me, the thing that bubbles to the top and starts sprouting out of everything, usually my sharp tongue, is the worst. Never the best that comes out first. So slow down, think about this, let this bring the best out in me, right? So he goes on and he says, when someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer, for then you'll be working out your true selves, your God-created selves. See, this is what the gospel does, puts us back in touch with, that's why we've got to be committed to what it's about, puts us back in touch with our God-created selves, not our selves that went AWOL from God, but our God-created selves. Right? And then he goes on and he says, this is what God does. He gives his best, and it goes on and talks the sun to warm and the rain to nourish to everyone, regardless the good and the bad, to the nice and the nasty. So it's almost like God lets the sun shine on the bad and the good. And most people go, well, how can God allow bad to exist? Or you're still alive. What's your scale? What's good? What's bad? You look at what God says is good, bad, and we all fall short. We all fail on the on the picture, right? The way I'm going here, I don't have to prepare for next week's message because point four is still left over. But so, right? So it goes here. It says, if all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anybody can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, do you expect a medal? Any run-of-the-mill sinner does that. In a word, I'm saying is, grow up, your kingdom subjects, now live like it, live out of your God-created identity, right? What does living out of God-created identity look like? Live generously and graciously towards others the way God lives towards you. So live generously towards other people. Just make a decision to take the bigger picture. I've got 4 minutes, so I might as well finish my message. Worship team, you come, which you can start all your hurry up music. Oh, you're already here. I've got 3 minutes and 40 seconds, right? So we're talking about, you know, a commitment to the gospel, a life that is a life's work, helping people understand this message, as a commitment to social, an authentic social connection that is represented by this, that is where we actually get to form this, a collective self-interest where everyone benefits from what we are contributing to each other. A commitment to live in a life of generosity, a bigness. Let's be people who've got a bigness about us. You know, they've got a bigness. Ask yourself, am I a big person? And a commitment and a focus, a commitment to the one. Two thoughts. Colossians chapter 4, verses 2 to 6. Often we put it up when we say, you know, at the end of the service, where we say, hey, is there someone in your world that doesn't know Jesus, right? The reason I put this scripture up, because to me, it's always a reminder that no matter where you are, you can always line yourself up with what God is trying to do. Big picture, what is God trying to do? He's trying to draw humanity into relationship with Him. And I believe you align yourself with that objective of God and be part of trying to help work out the outcomes, then you're always going to be in a good place. Life's just going to be in a good place. So Paul says, you know, despite the fact that I'm here in jail, he's at the end of his life somewhat, despite the fact that I'm here in jail, I still ask that you would pray for me, that I'd have opportunity and God would give me wisdom to be able to reveal Jesus, this life work of mine in the context, to the people around me. Think about that. That one person, a commitment to the one. We live in a world where we can make sweeping generalizations about large portions of humanity. We can encounter one person that represents one aspect of humanity, and because of that one encounter, if we're not careful, we can make a sweeping judgment or a sweeping accusation, or we can characterize everybody according to. But that's not how Jesus works. Jesus treats everybody as unique, a part of one overarching, one humanity. He doesn't divide us up. He sees us as one humanity, but we're a whole lot of unique people in it. All right? So the one being the focus. Let's not fall into the trap of sweeping generalizations about people, because that's the beginning of bigotry. And all we're doing today is we're redefining bigotry with our modern philosophies. We're just, if you think about it, if you're someone who thinks that way, we're just redefining all sorts of things. But here's the best definition of the things that really matter. The one, just that one person. Let's be committed to that one, that one person that doesn't know Jesus. Let's be committed to that, the one that's next to you. The one that you call the person you go to church with or you sit next to in church, or you might not even know them. Start with, hey, I'm going to think about you. It's amazing how quickly you might get to know them, or you might look and go, oh, there's no way known. I want to be known. I want to know you. But then you think they might need you to know them. Let's not make it about us. Let's make it about them, the one that's next to you. The one that does, that's next to you, that doesn't know Jesus in the workplace or wherever it may. The one that does know him. The one. Just think about the one. Just be careful to turn to, oh, it's all these people, my church. It's just made up of a whole lot of one people. A whole lot of one people. The one that's gone missing. I know I've said this before, but who do you know that's gone missing? Do you care? That's not a slap, by the way. It's just a challenge. But do we care? Or is it just all about me? As long as it's working for me. But no, the one that doesn't know him, the one that is beside me, the one that's here, the one that's gone missing, the one that is the offended one, the one that feels like they've failed and just needs someone to come back and say, no, you haven't failed. You misplaced the gospel in your mind if you think you've failed. Last thought, in John chapter 21. The singers come this way. That's an even stronger hint. The pulpit person, you can. That's an even better hint. Thank you. In John 21, there's this great account where you've got Peter who is out fishing, all right? And he's gone back. You know, the funny thing is Peter had disappointed Jesus. He'd denied him three times. He was absent, all right? He was absent when it comes to the crucifixion. He was a really key player in the whole Jesus' life before his arrest, but absent. And he'd in a sense in himself, I guess, betrayed Jesus somewhat. He'd let him down. He probably was defeated, whatever. And what did he do? He went back to his old life. He went back to fishing. After Jesus was resurrected, it says that Jesus went, call it by the seashore, and Peter was out fishing, and he called out, hey, drop down your nets. Peter's mind went, I know who that is, because I've been told to do this before. All right? Peter's response immediately was that he jumped out of the boat and ran to Jesus. Now you think, you read that, and I was talking to Chris Mickelson recently. He says, what type of person must Jesus have been that Peter, in all of his disappointment with himself, still felt that he could jump out of the boat and run to Jesus in the midst of his failure? What sort of person must Jesus have been? Now, I see two challenges in that. Is Jesus that person to you? Is he that in the midst of your failing, Come on, he's the dude that Peter, in the midst of his failure, he'd even gone back. But as soon as he went, there he is, he went running without any fear. He just boldly ran. What sort of person must Jesus have been? Make sure he's that person in your life. Keep him that person. But then the challenges I talked about, the one that doesn't know him, the one that is around you. Can we be committed to each other? Committed to the ones that don't know him. But you know, can we be committed to being like Jesus in the way that we are, so that when, you know, when people fail and they fail you, are you the first one they run to? Now, I say that and I go, my goodness. Am I the first one someone runs to when they fail? I want to be. And I believe that's who we should be. We just commit ourselves to the simplicity of these things. Now, I just think we could be a light in a dark place. Amen? Come on, why don't you stand to your feet?
This is the end of this podcast. We hope you have been challenged and inspired. For more information about Hillsong Church London, please visit hillsong.co.uk.